You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm happy to have with me for the first time Danielle DiMartino Booth. Danielle is the founder of Money Strong, LLC. It's an economic consulting firm. She began her career in New York at Donaldson, Lufkin, Jenneret, and Credit Suisse, where she worked in fixed income and the public and private equity markets. After working as a financial columnist at the Dallas Morning News, Danielle spent 9 years as an advisor to Richard Fisher at the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. And she is also the author of a newly written book titled Fed Up, An Insider's Take on Why the Federal Reserve is Bad for America. In her book, she criticizes the Fed for focusing too much on theoretical economic and academic models and not enough on the way markets work in the real world. Well, since this show is itself highly critical of the Fed, having had in the past guests like Ron Paul, David Stockman, Jim Rickards, to name a few, I'm really pleased to welcome Danielle for yet another critical perspective on the Federal Reserve Bank, which is, for sure, an extremely powerful institution, but an unelected institution. Danielle, thank you so much for joining me at Turning Hard Times into Good Times.
I'm happy to be here this afternoon. How are you?
I'm really good. I'm really good here in New York City, and I imagine you're on a book tour now and traveling around on a very rigorous schedule. What part of the country are you in today?
Well, actually, I will be in New York today.
Oh, okay. Well, that's interesting. And at a Barnes & Noble or someplace like that, perhaps?
No, coming in to do media around the release of the meeting minutes for the last FOMC meeting.
Oh, great. We'll see you on Bloomberg or CNBC or someplace
CNBC.
Like that. Oh, great. Well, look forward to that. Great. Wonderful. Well, before we get started on some of the ideas in your book, I found it really interesting, some of the color that you provided with regard to the culture of the Federal Reserve. For example, on page 82, regarding Richard Fisher, with whom you worked, you said, and I quote, "Fisher's comments often provided a better look at where the economy was going than other speakers, at least in hindsight. But his charm and lack of a PhD meant that many on the FOMC and board staff did not take him seriously," end of quote. So would you say that there is a culture of hubris at the Fed, you know, a tiny club of Ivy League PhDs who believe they know the truth about how markets work, or at least about markets, and anyone outside of that club is clueless?
Well, I wouldn't say that there, well, the hubris part is a given, but I certainly wouldn't say that there were, that they claim any great knowledge of the way markets operate. They certainly purport to understand how the economy works, but the area, if you will, where the knowledge is lacking is at the intersection of the financial markets and economic data. And that is where people like Richard Fisher and myself were able to shine.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly the Federal Reserve was designed to be a lender of last resorts. And, you know, we've had guests on this show like Ron Paul, who would like to end the Fed completely. Others like David Stockman concede that the Fed acting as lender of last resort may have its place, but it should not be creating endless amounts of money out of thin air and in the process denying price discovery of capital. In the first chapter of your book, you said that I wrote this book to tell from the inside the story of how the Fed went from being a lender of last resort to savior and then destroyer of America's economic system, end of quote. From what I have read in the book, it seems to me that you might be more in David Stockman's camp. That is, you believe there is a place for the Fed, but that it shouldn't be so aggressive in trying to stimulate the economy. Do I have that right?
Yes. You know, I have a hard time putting myself in the same camp as anybody in particular. I don't necessarily think that the world as we know it is going to end. I think that there are a ton of risks out there. But I'm also of the opinion that ending the Fed is not the right way to go if you reinvent it in a rational way such that it is populated with leaders who have no agenda. And it really does come down to that simple of a statement. No agenda.
Well, let me ask you, what do you think the agenda of these PhD folks from Harvard, Princeton, and Yale is? What is their agenda?
Well, if you look at what motivates people, look at a Wall Street banker. What motivates a Wall Street banker? Greed.
Money. Yeah.
Money. Yeah, sure. Plain and simple. If you look at what motivates academic economists from the time that they're earning their PhDs, the Shangri-La for them, the ultimate carrot, is when they get published in a prestigious journal.
Mm-hmm.
And that is where they find validation within their peer group. And the one thing that I found to be so disturbing, if you will, is that that same goal was really driving most of the people inside the Fed. And there were others, if you will, who were beating the table for a lot of the people on the inside to do more real-time work that helped policymakers understand, you know, kind of how the economy was really working, as opposed to furthering a school of thought or exemplifying to the world just how brilliant you were. Look, I don't deny it. These people are really, really smart. But as William McChesney Martin said, of academics, you always want to have these people on tap. You never want to have them on top.
Well, it certainly is. It's pride and ego, I guess, to a great extent, then, isn't it? It would seem to be the case.
It's pride, it's ego, and it's habit. It's the way that they're used to doing things. And look, even Keynes famously wrote about the paradox of thrift. And I wrote about this last week for Bloomberg.
Yes.
And he warned that if you leave interest rates at too low of a level, you're going to end up catalyzing aggregate savings across an economy, which will cause people to pull back on their spending and put a governor on economic growth. He actually warned about low interest rates, which I find to be, there's a certain irony with a lot of the people in the media using Keynes as kind of the poster boy of the quantitative easing, negative interest rate era, because I think the behavior of central bankers today have Keynes spinning in his grave.
Yeah, it's very interesting, and it makes all the sense in the world, Danielle, because when you think about the amount of money that savers are foregoing, they're not able to spend. They don't have that income from savings. I think, you know, as a senior citizen myself, how much and how badly I am being hurt. I can remember the time when I was a young man, had to pay 17.5% for my first mortgage. Wow, would I like to have, now that I have the savings that I have, would I ever love to have anything close to that in terms of yields on my savings? And that would, you know, with something that's fairly safe like treasuries, instead of going out and having to speculate in the stock market to get to generate cash flow. Is that the idea, that there's that income isn't available, so people then are saying, "Uh-oh, I'm going to have to really save, so I'm sure I have enough money to pay for the mortgage or the rent or my food or the healthcare or things I have to have to survive." Is that what's going on with this paradox of thrift argument?
I think that's fair, but I call it taking grandma to Vegas. I mean, I'm sorry, but our seniors should not be forced into the junk bond market. This is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, the funny thing is that the Ben Bernanke's of the world have actually said in their own words, you know, we are looking to ignite animal spirits. Well, that's appropriate if you're at the beginning of your career.
Yeah.
But it's certainly not appropriate in an era of, you know, that began with Greenspan beginning to monkey with price discovery, which has really skewed valuations and even made the ability to build a reasonable portfolio difficult to do, because you've killed the efficient frontier. You've killed the ability to diversify a portfolio as a factor of time, because you've killed price discovery. I'm saying the ones with, you know, the killers here are the central bankers.
Yeah. Well, certainly the efficient frontier, the idea is that you have different asset classes moving in different directions, right? And you want to be on that frontier so you get the optimum return for any given level of risk, risk being defined as variance of return. And if it seems to me, Danielle, what's happening is almost everything is moving together these days. Is that a fair statement?
Well, and you know what? It has been a fair statement for a while. I was relaying a story I was relaying a conversation recently that I had had with Charlie Munger. This is years mm-hmm. ago. You might agree that Charlie Munger of the two, Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, Charlie Munger is the apolitical one, no governor yes. in the mouth, says what comes
right.
to mind without thinking twice. And a conversation we had was maybe not in my lifetime, Danielle, but in yours, you'll see the efficient frontier go the way of the dodo bird because in overly intrusive central bankers have killed the ability to diversify our portfolio such that your correlations tend to line up as a factor of time. And all of a sudden, those commodities that were going to shepherd your portfolio and allow you to hedge during disruptive market times, they don't work anymore. The bonds that you bought to act as a flight to safety in the event that your equity portfolio blew up, they don't provide you safe cover anymore either. It really is it's a disastrous outcome that we should have learned from in 2009 and 2010, and the fact that the central bankers of the world didn't learn from it caused me to get really fed up and write a book about it.
Yeah. Who did you write the book for, Danielle? Who did you want to read this? I mean, I find it fascinating, but I'm in these markets. It's what I do. Are you getting any policymakers reading it?
Oh, heavens no. I don't have a PhD, so I don't even qualify for them to open it up and read the dedication.
That's sad. But
I didn't write it for them. Trust me when I say I did not write it for them because they're not going to change the way they do things. I wrote it for the everyday man. It was written once so that the policy and the meat on the bones could be in there, and then it was translated into the Queen's English so that it's an accessible book for everybody who thinks that the Federal Reserve is some secretive order of bankers out to destroy the world. It really isn't. It's just a bunch of academics.
Right. Of course, they would like to keep people thinking that it's not accessible. It is a very readable book, I might add. It's very easy to read. This can't go on, though, forever, can it, Danielle? I mean, we can't have it. I mean, this equity market, whenever, as David Stockman has said repeatedly, whenever the equity markets start to tank and throw a hissy fit, the Fed backs away from any talk of raising rates. And now they seem to be talking about raising rates a lot. I'm wondering if market forces might not be forcing the Fed's hand, or what are your thoughts on this? And it seems to me that what they're trying to do is convince people they have everything under control. So they talk like they're going to raise rates. The economy's strong to justify raising rates. And then what happens is you have a shock in the equity market or some bad economic news, and they sort of back away from it, and the equity market takes off and has another bullish run. How long can this go on, and what might cause it to break down, if anything?
Well, look, I don't want to feed any kind of political meme here, but I am concerned that all throughout the years of the prior administration, if the equity market said boo, the Fed would come running to the rescue. I mean, you didn't even really need a 5 or 6% downside in equities, to say nothing of a true 10% correction, in order to really get the Fed off the mark and into DEFCON 1 mode and putting more liquidity out there. So I find it to be very curious that now they're not only talking about tightening by way of raising interest rates in the traditional manner, but they're also talking about shrinking the balance sheet. Mm-hmm. And they know darn well that this economic cycle is long in the tooth, to be kind.
Sure.
It really is old, if you want to put a better word on it. So I find it to be very curious, unless the Fed is being political, that they would be talking not just about raising interest rates, but about beginning to shrink their balance sheet as well. They really are alluding to much tighter financial conditions going forward, which would suggest we're going to have a lot of downside in stocks.
Yeah, and so where do we run? Where do we go?
Oh, gosh. I mean, my 70-year-old retired mother, I've got her in a in a Vanguard Ginny Mae fund, and so that way we both sleep at night and she barely keeps pace with inflation. And that's the false inflation that's announced by the Fed. You know, that's the quote-unquote core PCE that came in at 1.75% recently. Mm-hmm. But there are going to be very few places that I can be comfortable putting my mother's money at this juncture that I don't feel like she'd take a big hit to her principal.
You mentioned commodities aren't working any longer. Charlie Munger talked about how they wouldn't work and how, and in fact, it seems to have been the case. We're having what I guess is, you know, really negative interest rates or very, very low real interest rates, which has traditionally been very positive for gold. Any thoughts on gold as a possible safety net, a place where you might store some wealth?
Well, I consider gold to be not necessarily a potential viable alternative to currencies, and that'll probably get me a fair share of hate mail. but what I do consider gold to be is your ultimate safe haven investment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you think that the central bankers of the world are going to do their dire best to launch QE4 or Lord knows what else, the Mario Draghi's buying corporate bonds, the Bank of Japan is buying stock ETFs. If you think that the same situation is going to come to pass here in the United States, and obviously the price of gold right now is reflecting that the Fed is going in the opposite direction, that they're headed towards a tightening path, then mm-hmm. gold is your ultimate safe haven.
Yeah. I'm wondering, I'm reading some things, whether they're true or not, I'm not absolutely sure, but that China, maybe Saudi Arabia, and some of these countries have been pulling back from treasuries, have been even reducing their holdings of U.S. treasuries. Could that be one of the reasons that the Fed is raising rates? Maybe they have to raise rates, or their balance sheet is going to have to continue to expand in order to fund U.S. deficits, which aren't going to fall anytime in the near future, the way it looks.
Well, for the moment, at least, for the moment, foreign buyers are still present enough, if you will, but you are absolutely correct. Especially at the long end, they've begun to pull back, and in fact, in 2016, were net sellers of mm-hmm. our treasuries. Mm-hmm. And I sure do hope that somebody in Washington is paying attention to that. So there's a chance. I wish I could tell you that it's 100% probability, but there's a chance somebody's paying attention to that. Mm-hmm. But by the same token, pension funds are in such a bad way.
Oh.
And you know, the minute there's any kind of a yield attached to any kind of a decent maturity bond, I think you're going to have pension funds coming and riding in and buying everything that they could possibly get their hands on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and keep the rates from rising too much as a result of that.
Well, again, I think that any massive ramp up in interest rates is going to be more the result of a different type of a war.
What was that? A different type of a war? Could you explain?
As opposed to a currency war.
I see. Okay. All right.
If you look at FDR, I mean, he was in office for 8 years,
mm-hmm.
really, before actual war came and tremendous amounts of economic growth that would go hand in hand with rising interest rates because economic activity was spurring it. I chuckle. The reason I leave the financial news on hold is the whole idea, the notion that, boy, we're raising interest rates because the economy is just screaming and
yeah.
it's going to grow so fast that this is a happy, good reflection. I chuckle and I'm like, why did I have the volume on?
Right. Oh, that's exactly right. Why I turn it off very often. With just a couple of minutes left, Danielle, you talk about the Taylor rule in your book. Can you explain the Taylor rule? And is that something you think the Fed should follow?
I think you go from the fire to the frying pan if you say we're going to go from targeting 2% inflation, which has backed the Fed into one corner, to targeting the Taylor rule. Now, that being said, I think that there needs to be a lot more in the way of discipline when it comes to monetary policy making, and that something like the Taylor rule should long ago have been and held a greater part of the discussion. I think that had that been the case, that in 2011 and in 2012, rather than worrying about, oh gosh, should we be doing $85 billion a month or $75 billion a month, or I think that we would have been, I think we, sorry, I still have pronoun challenges and I've been gone for almost 2 years. I think Fed officials back then should have been looking at raising interest rates, and had the Taylor rule been more appreciated around the table at the FOMC, I think that there would have been more people voting to raise interest rates years ago. Mm-hmm. And that would put us in a better place today, by the way.
Oh, I guess it would. We have this, it seems to be exponential growth in debt. And yet, even using the Fed's or the government's, I would think, generous accounting of GDP, that it's, you know, it just seems logical to anyone that sooner or later the system has to break down. You mentioned pension funds. I can't imagine. I know some of them are starting to have challenges now. I think the Teamsters here in New York, I read recently, having trouble and have had to cut their members back dramatically. I can't imagine the political repercussions that are going to happen or are going to take place, and the strife that's going to happen. You know, if as people get older and their pension funds are just gone. I mean, it's just hard to think about. It's hard to know what's going to happen, isn't it?
It really is, and it's a sad state, because if you think about it, the teacher who toiled her life and Maybe the pension rules were such that she shouldn't have been able to pile on the last 48 hours of her pay and yeah, overtime and the whole thing. And that's part of the problem, I think, and that's part of the groundswell of anger that we're continuing to hear because they grab good headlines. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, that teacher earned her pension.
Yeah.
And now what?
Yeah.
By the same token, the person whose income taxes in the state of Illinois are going up, or property taxes are going up because they're going to have to top off that teacher's pension, they're in their rights as well, saying, I'm moving to Texas. Why would I want to sit around and pay up when you're talking about me not being able to get as much as I should out of my 401k or IRA because my property taxes are going up late in life when I'm trying to live on my fixed income? It is a dilemma. I think it's going to be politicians' biggest challenge over the next 20 years.
Yeah, and with the demographics running against them as well, against the budget deficit, it certainly will be fascinating, but I think very very frightening as well. One more thing, Danielle, before we let you go. On the campaign trail, Donald Trump was pretty critical of the Fed. Do you hold out any hope that anything positive might come out of this administration with respect to the Fed?
I'm losing hope more quickly than I would hope.
I'm sorry to hear that.
For a circuitous statement.
Yeah. Yeah.
I worry that he hasn't said more. I mean, this is a man who is erratic and tends to tweet in the middle of the night. So
yes,
I worry that we haven't heard a little bit more definitive direction, if you will, on where he is hoping the Fed will go. And, you know, if he's not capable of passing legislation, then he certainly won't be able to stomach higher interest rates. So it worries me that the one person who has the potential to ride into town and totally shake up the way things are done at the Fed, I worry that he's been so silent.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry to. We'll have to leave it go at that. Unfortunate note. I'm afraid I would agree with you and share your fears. I want to thank you very much, Danielle, for being with us today. And I want to encourage people to buy the book. It's called Fed Up, An Insider's Take on Why the Federal Reserve is Bad for America. Thank you so much for being with us today, Danielle. Well, folks, that is all the time for this week's show. Next week, Daryl McMullen of Gold Money will be with us to talk about that company, how Gold Money is doing and what they're doing to help you actually use gold as money and use it for your purchases. And so we'll look forward to talking to Daryl next week. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Dynacert is a global leader in carbon emission reduction technologies. Created for use in diesel engines, the hydrogen unit has been proven to reduce carbon emissions by up to 40%, increase torque, improve engine oil quality, and provide up to 19% in fuel savings. Our leading-edge technology is designed for tractor trailers, rail, marine, and newly developed for diesel engine cars. Reducing the amount of greenhouse gases provides benefits to the environment, to communities and businesses, and to our shareholders.
Golden Predator Mining Corp., a well-financed gold exploration company operating in Canada's Yukon. Focused on advancing its Three Aces project, a high-grade gold project located in the southeast Yukon with gold and quartz outcrops at surface. Ongoing work includes trenching, roadwork, drilling, and bulk sampling. Golden Predator also holds the past-producing Brewery Creek project located near Dawson City, Yukon. Golden Predator, a company working closely with Yukon First Nations. Golden Predator trades on the Canadian Venture Market as GPY, and in the U.S. OTC market as NTGSF.
Chilean Metals is a Canadian junior exploration company focusing on high-potential copper, gold prospects in Chile and Canada. Chilean Metals' Zulima property is a Candelaria-like prospect, one of the largest mines in the world. The company has begun its drill program in Chile on its Zulima property and should be completed by the end of February. We also own a 3% royalty on future production on Teck Resources' Copaquiri property, potentially worth millions of dollars annually. This is the time to invest in Chilean Metals, a discovery story with a hedge. Traded TSX Venture under symbol CMX.
Arvista Gold's only asset is the Douay Gold Project, which is located in northern Quebec. The Douay Project currently hosts an NI 43101 resource of approximately 3 million ounces of gold and is considered to be the largest undeveloped and independent gold project in Quebec. Arvista has significant upside potential to further grow its resources and is currently undergoing an extensive 2017 drill campaign. Arvista Gold trades on the TSXV under the symbol AVA and on the OTCQB under the symbol ARVSF. For more information on Arvista, please visit arvistagold.com.
Tri-Metals Mining is a growth-focused mineral exploration company exploring and developing its near-surface Gold Springs gold-silver project in mining-friendly Nevada and Utah. Tri-Metals has only drilled less than 10% of the gold targets at Gold Springs, and it already has a gold resource with a robust preliminary economic assessment. Tri-Metals believes that with further drilling, there is a significant potential to discover 3 to 5 million ounces of gold at Gold Springs. Tri-Metals shares are listed on the OTCQX and the TSX under symbols TMIAF and TMI respectively, and its website is trimetalsmining.com.